We're going to pick up our conversation on immigration.
Okay.
And see where we were. We had kind of done a brief survey of immigration issues last week. I kind of want to go back and look at our 6 points and talk about that in the light of immigration, refugees, migration, and how you might make both just and ethical decisions in the light of that. So let's start with individual versus group rights. All right? And we're going to start with, let's talk about the right of the individual migrant versus the group rights of American society. And when we exhaust that discussion, we'll flip it, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about the right of the individual American versus the migrant population as a group, the group rights of migrants. Does that make sense?
Right.
So let's start with the individual migrant versus the group rights of American citizens, keeping in mind we're talking about Christian social justice. So within the framework of all of the things we've talked about, of both Old Testament teaching, New Testament teaching, further teachings of the church on issues of both the vulnerable and the stranger, how do we parse the individual right of the migrant versus the group right of American citizens?
Well, when would they be in conflict?
Well,
they're in conflict, right now.
Say more.
Well, people are just looking at it as, somebody who's coming in is going to take all of our
jobs.
Not just jobs, but also our resources mm-hmm. and our benefits mm-hmm. versus their rights to mm-hmm. have jobs and all that.
But if they're mm-hmm. legal immigrants, you know.
It's hard to become a legal immigrant. I mean, there are so many requirements right now. Mm-hmm. It's not like it used to be. That's a different classification than refugees, mm-hmm. legally.
But when we're talking
different.
About migrants, are we including refugees?
Well, let's break that out. Mm-hmm. When we talk about people who are migrating from one place to another, and particularly when we're talking about American migration, you're talking about several different classes of people. Mm-hmm. You're talking about refugees, those claiming asylum. Well, actually, you're talking about 3 different classes. Refugee is someone who has already been identified as having a refugee is a legal category. So the refugees who get resettled in Buffalo don't just show up at the border and say, "Hi, I'm a refugee." They come from refugee camps elsewhere where they've been identified, background checked, admitted to the United States, sponsored, and then resettled into the United States. So that's one process. And that's a legal form of entry, but it takes between 24 months and 10 years. For a refugee from the day they arrive at a UN refugee facility to become resettled in the United States. So that's one class of individual migrants. Then there are the people who are seeking asylum. And that's another group that's protected by international law and by treaties to which the U.S. is a signatory. And the way the law of that works is you have to enter the United States. And the law is very clear, either at a port of entry or in any other way. So it doesn't matter how you get into the U.S. But once you're in the U.S., you present yourself to a government official and claim asylum. So that can be, and the way we were used to seeing this happen when I was growing up was, a Russian gymnast or ballerina would be on tour here and would sneak away from
the group and
claim asylum. But that's not the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. Basically, all you have to do is get yourself to the U.S.
American soil.
To American soil mm-hmm. and claim that you have a fear of persecution should you be returned to your country of origin.
So those people are...
Well, eventually, but in order to start the process, you don't.
Those people are not necessarily legal.
Either. Not necessarily. You don't have to enter the country legally to claim asylum.
Right. There's a big center in Buffalo. I used to volunteer there for asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. It was started by two Catholic nuns who the people came to their door and asked for asylum. Mm-hmm. Then it grew to be enormous, and it was, it became too much for them. So now there is a social service agency that runs it.
And they would step over from Canada, I assume?
Or arrive in another way.
They don't even know. These two guys from Sri Lanka appeared at the door. They have no idea.
Okay.
So how they even heard about it.
Yeah, you can get a tourist visa, which is relatively easy to do, arrive in the United States, and then claim asylum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, that's how you get to the United States is kind of irrelevant to the asylum process. Mm-hmm. The asylum process is also really difficult. It involves an initial hearing to see if you have, at initial look, a legitimate fear of persecution for the specific reasons that are in the law. Right? Just because you're afraid to go home doesn't necessarily mean you qualify for asylum. That you have to have a fear of persecution on religious grounds, on political grounds, on domestic violence grounds. So there's some rules about that. And then there's a series of hearings through which you have to present increasing amounts of evidence of your justified fear of persecution should you be returned home. And eventually, then, as you work through the process, you will be granted asylum. Should you jump over all those bars to the satisfaction of the judge that is hearing the case. What's interesting about the asylum process is the government is not required to have you represented by counsel. So one of the things that's happening at the border now is that parents are coming with their children and claiming asylum. They're separating the parents from their children because they are. And then they're putting them through the asylum process separately. So there have been cases of 2 and 3-year-old children being brought before immigration judges and asked to make their asylum claim. Now, let's talk about social justice.
Yeah, legal harassment.
Yeah, this is patently unjust to ask a 3-year-old who doesn't speak English to ask a 3-year-old who does speak English, but to ask certainly to ask a 3-year-old who has,
Well, initially though, do we you were mentioning the rights of the people who migrate? Just basically, do they have a right to live without fear of harm?
One,
is that what you're looking for? What rights do they have?
Well, it depends on who you think is the arbiter of that. Mm-hmm. The UN Declaration of Human Rights says that you do have the right to live without fear of persecution on the basis of religion, ethnic identity, race, gender, all of the protected classes you would think about. The UN Declaration of Human Rights says you have the right to live without fear of persecution based on those things. Now, is that the ultimate arbiter? And do we as Christians hold a higher standard or a lower one?
I was just wondering also, what role does history play in this kind of consideration? Because it has been different in history than
it has been
right
different
now.
In history than it is right now. It has been different in history than it is right now, both in terms of the concept of national borders and also the concept of who's permitted to enter your country, right? And we talked about this a little bit last week, but I do get tired of people saying, well, my relatives came legally. Not really. First of all, there were not any immigration laws until really relatively recently. And then the first immigration laws were to keep out groups of people. And it's hard to see those laws as based on anything other than racial animus. So, I mean, one of them is actually called the Chinese Exclusion Act. So, you know, when you title that as the law, you kind of got to expect that people are going to say, perhaps there's some racial animus there. So, but it's really post-World War II that you begin to see things like nations setting up quotas of people who can come from a particular nation, and really kind of specific laws about.
Well, I understand the Jews weren't. I mean, there was no sympathy there when Hitler, and I didn't realize that. I'm just starting to hear some of that.
Oh, yes.
The
United States did not open its doors to refugees to Jewish refugees from Germany during World War II. As a matter of fact, it turned away Jewish refugees from Germany on a pretty regular basis, including a boatload of Jewish children who we refused to accept and Canada did. So,
do we still have quotas?
Yes. We have quotas. Now, let me be clear. When we talk about quotas, we're talking about quotas for immigrants who wish to come here legally on a path to citizenship. That's different than some of the visa classifications that allow people to come here to work for a period of time. Mm-hmm. But if you wish to become an American citizen at some point and you want to immigrate here legally, there are quotas for every nation.
And how are they established?
By the Congress.
I mean, on what basis? So, like the size of each nation? Like, we take more Chinese than we would...
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It has to do... And I don't know the answer to that. I just know that every year the Congress and the State Department publish a list of...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is how many people we will admit from each particular nation. Mm-hmm. And while there is a queue or a line, there are also ways to jump that. For example, family reunification. So if your child is an American citizen, you get to move forward in the line. If your spouse is an American citizen, you get to move forward in the line. And also, in certain cases, if you have a close family member who's an American citizen and resident in the United States, you can be granted a residency visa, whereas normally you have to wait for permission to enter the United States in the country where you're applying.
And it sounded like that extended, at least that's the argument I've heard, that extended to cousins and grandparents. And
It extends to what's called first-level relatives. So it's... parents and children, spouses, and then brothers, sisters. So that's grandparents.
So that nucleus.
Yeah, that level of family. So that's how Melania Trump is a citizen, because she married an American citizen and became a citizen that way. She was able to make her parents citizens through this family reunification.
Where did she come
from? Slovenia.
Oh, good.
And she was probably here on a work visa.
Yes.
To meet him.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Which is a whole other way to enter the country is through work visas, which there's a whole bunch of those. There's religious worker visas. There's H-1B visas. There's creative worker visas.
There's probably educational visas too.
That's a different kind of visa, but yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they may or may not come with the permission to work in the country.
Mm-hmm. Usually the student visas, though, they can't work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, if you're here on a student visa, you're not allowed to work while you're here. Mm-hmm. There are also tourist visas that give people permission to enter the country for a period of time to be a tourist. And those don't come with permission to work. When we talk about immigration, the vast majority of people who are in America illegally today have overstayed a visa of one form or another. They entered the country legally with a visa and just simply didn't go home.
I've heard that.
Yeah. And then also there you can enter the country illegally by crossing the border at someplace other than a port of entry. So a port of entry is the Peace Bridge, right, is a port of entry. So is the airport, right, where you go through an immigration process, right? And we've all crossed the border into Canada and back and know what that process is like. Okay.
Question.
Sure.
This is based on something we talked about last week, the fear of, what's her name again?
Gigi.
Mm-hmm. Was afraid of the Christians becoming a minority in a U.S. becoming a country of dominated by the Islam religion. Now, is that a motivation? That kind of thing, is that any motivation when we set our quotas? Do we want to keep the U.S., I don't know, white, Christian, whatever, Anglo-Saxon, you know?
It certainly was at the beginning, when we first started instituting immigration laws and immigration quotas. It certainly was. We gave lots of preference to
like European
European places. After the 1970s, the Supreme Court really struck down a lot of laws and quotas that were based on religion and race, because as a nation faced our own history of segregation and racial discrimination, and then also that kind of, we began to have conversations about, well, we say that, you know, the First Amendment says you're not allowed to make, the government's not allowed to make decisions on the basis of religion. So how can they make decisions on the basis of religion? So as we became a more inclusive, and I certainly would say just, nation, we applied that to our immigration laws as well as to our...
But I think there's been some argument people make
that
those people are not citizens of the United States. Should they be entitled to the same
protection? Well, and then the question is it the people that we're protecting, or is it that we are requiring that our laws reflect our stated values? So it's not necessarily that a non-citizen may not have the protection. I may be allowed to discriminate against you because you're Muslim and not an American citizen, but should American law be allowed to discriminate? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
I know that's part of an argument.
Yes.
That some people would make.
Right. Mm-hmm. So and that comes back to individual versus group rights. Mm-hmm. Does the individual is the individual protected by our Constitution, or does the Constitution apply to the way our laws treat groups?
I think that was the argument, like in 9/11, people who were accused of doing that, should they be entitled to the same treatment under the law? Maybe that's where I heard that. I don't remember where.
Right, and we certainly, we have people that we're continuing to hold in Cuba, because the settled legal principle in the United States is that the Constitution follows our flag, so that the Constitution applies to everyone within the... If you're on American soil, the Constitution applies to you.
Whether
you're a citizen or not. That our laws follow our flag. Okay. So that our laws apply to everyone in our country, which is pretty standard. You know, you often hear this on TV that you know, some American college kid goes to Turkey and gets arrested with, you know, marijuana in his bag. And in Turkey, having a small amount of marijuana is a life sentence. And, you know, their parents complain that, well, you know, that law's unjust. It's like, yes, but it's their law. And you're in their country, so you follow their law. When I have visited Saudi Arabia, I've worn hijab because their law says if you're going to be in public, that's what you have to do. And you're in their country and you follow their law. The same thing applies here. If you're in our country, our laws apply to you. this is another interesting social justice slash ethics dilemma. In the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we arrested some people who we believed were terrorist high-ups. We didn't want to bring them into America because once they reached here,
different laws applied.
They had constitutional protections. Mm-hmm. They had to, including the right to a speedy trial and to confront the witnesses against them and all of those things. So we held them in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which is not on U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm. Even though we don't recognize Cuba.
Right.
Right.
But it's
and they're still there, these people.
And some of them are still there. Because we then didn't bring them to a place where our constitutional rights applied to them. So that's an ethical question. Is that really okay to do that? And do we like that as, you know, and to bring it back to Christian social justice, do we like that as Christians for a government operating in our name?
Well, they were using torture there.
Mm-hmm. Again, because constitutional protections.
Because I remember some people wanted them brought back to New York to stand on trial there, mm-hmm. and some people didn't want them to have the protections of mm-hmm. a lawyer and a speedy trial and all that. Mm-hmm. So they kept them down there and tried to do some military trials. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So that's, and that's kind of a separate issue from immigration, but it's a similar kind of thing, yeah. It, rights mm-hmm. and privileges.
It's all interesting, very interesting. Mm-hmm. How does the religious right look at the rights of people from other religions? Because that doesn't seem Christian to me.
That's an interesting question.
It doesn't
question.
Seem ethical, but it also doesn't
seem Christian.
Christian.
That's an interesting question. When you talk about the religious right, you're talking about a relatively large group of people, and there's a lot of nuance in that, and it's also changed recently.
They aren't one particular denomination, though.
Not necessarily, no. Mm-hmm. That's a more complicated answer, but we'll do for now.
That's behind Trump that is demanding this wall?
Somewhat.
I've heard that on the news.
Yes.
I don't know if it's a religious right, but it's a right branch of the Republican Party. It is really...
Yes, and some of those people, a lot of those people would call themselves evangelical Christians.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the conversations going on within the church community right now is to what extent are evangelical Christian leaders supporting the president for political reasons rather than for religious reasons, and wait a minute, in the past you've made these religious claims, which actually, let me back up a little bit, and I'll get there, I promise, but let me back up a little bit, and let's talk about... Because we kind of skated over this. What is the role of a religious person in the public affairs of a pluralistic nation? All right?
Wait a minute, what do you mean by pluralistic?
Pluralistic? So we are a nation that has, as one of our foundational rights, the right to freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. Which means we don't have an established church.
Okay, pluralistic means allowing for different religions.
Different religions, different denominations and different religions, mm-hmm. and no religions, ostensibly anyway, equally. Now, in our history, we have not done that. We've done that better at some times than others. But let's claim our foundational document as our goal. All right, so our goal is to be a nation with freedom of religion so that we do not have an established church, we do not have a religious test to serve in government. For example, in England, until very, very recently, you had to be a member of the Church of England to serve in Parliament.
Don't we officially have separation of church and state?
Well, that's a phrase, but it's not...
Oh,
what's in our Constitution, it gets described as separation of church and state, But what our Constitution says is Congress, which has been expanded to include all agencies of government, and that's the 14th Amendment, but Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, which means giving special rights to a particular establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Okay, so Congress, which since the 14th Amendment after the Civil War has been taken to mean all government, so not just Congress, state government, city government, school systems, anything that's the government, can make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, before the Civil War, Congress meant Congress. And so the states could respect an establishment of religion, and many of them did. The Episcopal Church was the state religion of many of the southern states until the Civil War. The Catholic Church was the state religion of Rhode Island until the Civil War. The community church, the outgrowth of the Puritan Church, was the state religion of Massachusetts. Okay. So, because until the Civil War, Congress meant Congress. After the Civil War, Congress meant, well, after the 14th Amendment, which is just after the Civil War, Congress meant all.
Any public
body. So, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So that's the statute, or the standard, except Congress has a chaplain who opens Congress every day with prayer. Clarence invites the Clarence Christian Ministers Association to send a representative every meeting to open our town board with prayer. They don't invite the Sikh temple, who is in Clarence, to...
And what religion is that?
Sikh. That's a religion.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't invite the Jewish temples or the Muslim
mosque
that's within the bounds of Clarence to be part of that rotation. So are we respecting an establishment of religion? Or... you know, so what does that mean? We give, I am doing the paperwork now, we give churches exemptions from property taxes and sales taxes. Now that we extend to other religious groups, but you have to prove that you're a religion. So that puts the state in the position of deciding what's a religion and what's not. Mm-hmm. And let's take it a different way. We serve alcohol to children as a part of our religious rituals. So do the Catholics, right? We use wine in communion. We do not prevent children from receiving communion. So every Sunday, we violate the law that says you don't give alcohol to children, except that there's an exemption in the law for religious purposes. But would we extend that, and do we extend that to Native American religions that include smoking peyote? Well, we haven't in the past. Not just for children, but for anybody. There are Native Americans in prison right now for using peyote in their religious rituals. So are we treating the religions equally when it comes to controlled substances?
So it almost seems like the religions that are more populated, mm-hmm. stronger, have more advocacy, mm-hmm. are the ones that get their way.
Mm-hmm. Every state has mandated reporters for child sexual abuse, right? in most states that have those laws, clergy are mandated reporters. Many states who have those laws have an exemption for confession. Not every state, but many states that have those laws. So why confession and not any other kind of pastoral conversation or religious conversation with a religious leader, right? So you see the standard, but then the practice is a little different. Now let's talk about how does the individual believer enter the public square, and how should the church speak in the public square?
Right.
All right. Now, churches, as I said, get tax exempt from the government. One of the rules of being a tax exempt organization is that you are not permitted to advocate for the election of any particular candidate. So I'm not allowed to put a sign on the church lawn that says, you know, vote for
Hillary.
Or vote for Donald Trump. I'm not allowed to do either one. However, you are allowed to advocate public policy in line with your religious beliefs. So the Episcopal Church has an office in Washington that advocates for positions that the Episcopal Church has taken. The bishops of the Episcopal Church go to Albany to advocate for positions that we think is important. The Catholic Church does the same.
What's the difference?
What's the objective difference? I mean, and then what's the subjective difference? Now, technically, if I wanted to invite candidates for governor to speak at this church, I'm allowed to do that as long as I extend the invitation to all the candidates, but I don't have to make sure they all accept. So I can invite, you know, everybody who's running for governor to come to this church, and if only Andrew Cuomo accepts, that's okay. I can let Andrew Cuomo speak here, as long as I extended the invitation to everybody. But is that in keeping with the spirit of, you know, and the other choice, of course, would be if you want to advocate for the election of a candidate, you could give up your tax exemption. But no church does that because it's a lot of money.
We went through this. I was high up in the PTA in Williamsville, and they also have tax exempt. And even candidates for school board, we weren't allowed to ever. And even in conversation, we weren't allowed to endorse anyone. So we had to be careful. But you did have individual rights. You could, you know, say something.
Right.
It's more that we were trying not to offend. And I think that's where it comes from. You know, you could have Andrew here, but if you cared about your community, you might say, I don't want anybody being upset.
Right.
So I'm going to make sure.
And as the pastor, I have to be the pastor to everybody in this church, not just the people who agree with me.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Support what you do. Yeah.
Right. So I have my own political views, but I give my political contributions anonymously because even if I don't use my title, I'm a public figure, and I don't want it to seem as if the church is endorsing politics. But not everybody feels that way. So where's the line? Where's the appropriate line? Where's the ethical line?
Especially, what if you see something that's unjust? You know how you said in church, I don't usually talk about anything, but separating the children from the parents is, could you write letters for this?
Right. When the government did the family separation policy and was taking the children away from the parish, I stood up in church and said, I don't usually comment on specific political action.
Right.
Because I don't. And I think Christians of good conscience come down on both sides of a lot of contentious issues. But we call ourselves the church the children built. And we can't do that with integrity if we only care about our own children. So here's the information about your elected representatives. I encourage you to get in touch with them. So that's, you know, and that's the challenge, is where are the lines, and how do you do it? And then also, as Christians, how do we take our personal beliefs into the public square? You know, Gigi was worried about Sharia law, about Islamic law becoming the law country. If you've watched The Handmaid's Tale, people are worried about evangelical interpretations or conservative Christian interpretations of Scripture becoming the law. So what's the difference between...
What part are they afraid of?
Women's rights being taken away.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Many of the things
that we fought for being rolled back.
Yeah. And some of that's coming... There's just now they don't want, like, to allow Christian businesses to allow birth control in there,
right.
To women in their insurance policies. There's things like that that are starting to creep into women's rights.
Right. If, you know, the law says that if you are a place of public business, public accommodation, you have to serve the whole public. You're not allowed to discriminate on all kinds of bases, including sexual orientation. But what if you're a baker being asked to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple and your religion is opposed to that? So how do you balance that? How do we as Christians take our ethical and positions into the public square, assuming that our ethics are informed by our religion? If your ethics aren't informed by your religion, I want to have a different conversation. But assuming that your ethics are informed by your religion, how do you take that into the public square and advocate for your view without imposing your religion on people who don't necessarily believe the same way you do? What's the line?
See, as a member of the Catholic Church, I felt like the church didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were brought up, live your religion. They can know who you are by the way you live your life.
Right.
I feel that church is starting to... Mm-hmm. Going more into that, telling people, judging people, I don't like that. I don't like it. I don't like when other religions come forward and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that happening more. You know, that's, you know, they can advocate for policies they want, but I don't like that. Because I feel, my feeling is, if you're in a public square, once you present yourself, if you're a business, you're going public, you're public.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that right to... to me, it's like if you refuse a black customer, that's what's different if you refuse a gay customer? To me, where are you saying I can refuse one but not the other? People are starting to draw lines, and I think it's getting worse and worse.
Mm-hmm. Question. Abusing children, for example, sexually or whatever, that's illegal, correct?
Correct.
Oh, yeah.
So why are not more of these priests going to jail?
Because there's statutes of limitations on that crime.
Okay. And they won't report it. Yeah.
Yeah. And
at the time, within the statute of the time.
And for one of the things we know about child sexual abuse, particularly child sexual abuse by trusted authority figures, so it's not just clergy, but teachers and parents, is that it takes between, on average, between 8 and 12 years for a child to be able to process that sufficiently to be able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an average, so some children can do it right away. Mm-hmm. Some children takes a whole lot longer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But 8 to...
Yeah.
Is the average. Well, the statute of limitations was 3 years after the child turned 18.
Yeah.
So...
I'm out of room there.
And also, if you're being, you know, if it's being hidden by an organization, that just extends. you know.
But the cover up was the great sin of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's, well, and this is a political thing. It's never the crime, it's the cover up.
It's the cover up, yeah.
Absolutely.
Politicians, you would think, would know that by now, but they don't seem to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the American public is really forgiving. Mm-hmm. And if you come out right away and say, I really messed up, mm-hmm. and I'm really sorry, and
we're going to move on.
Yeah. We're going to move on. This is what I'm going to do to make sure it never happens again. Mm-hmm. And
that's what we're not getting from the church. No. That's what we're getting. Oh, now all of a sudden they're admitting that we're not getting the, you know, yeah. let's see how yeah. I can make this
but
not happen.
But why in the world they didn't just boot the priests out of the church instead of covering it up and shifting them around? I don't get
it's,
it.
It's a couple of things. It's really hard to... for anybody to accept that somebody you like and trust mm-hmm. is capable of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The problem with sociopaths is that they don't come with sociopath tattooed on their forehead. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we learn in, we know about this, and that anybody who takes any of the child sexual abuse prevention classes will tell you is, it's not like child abusers come in and say, hey, I'm a child abuser.
Yeah.
They're not all creepy. Mm-hmm. You know, they're actually really good at mm-hmm. ingratiating themselves in, it's called grooming. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of pedophiles spend a lot of time mm-hmm. building up relationships with kids before, you know.
Mm-hmm. And they're so trusted.
Yes.
They were revered. They mm-hmm. were, you know, they were, sure. you were, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's this absolute authority thing, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and
but
then
that's
you,
also shattering, though, to the congregational people, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, my God, you know.
Yeah. And then you add to that the institution's instinct, which is usually to protect the institution. Mm-hmm. And that's true of mm-hmm. most institutions, mm-hmm. that the institution's instinct is to protect the institution. You add to that in the Catholic Church. Catholic Church's history is, in a lot of places, they were the law for a century or many centuries. Mm-hmm. They were the only law. And in a lot of places, the law is hostile to them. So you put those two things together, and mm-hmm. we're used to being our own law, and in a lot of places where the church operates, we can't trust the law. They don't call the police and report them. Mm-hmm. The Episcopal Church started child sexual abuse prevention policies in the late 80s. So by the time I was going to seminary, it was required that if you were being ordained to the priesthood, you had to take, we call it safe church, but sexual misconduct prevention training, and you had to renew it every certain number of years, and you had to have a background check, and, you know, we were putting policies in place about how the church operates, with how the church operates its children's programs, and in requiring lay people to be trained, and all of those things, too. And it was a big deal when it first got started. I was one of the people responsible for making sure that people got trained even before I was ordained. And you get, and you still, this day, although less now, but certainly when it started, you heard, well, do you think I'm a pedophile? Do you think, it's like, that's not why we're making you take the training. Mm-hmm. We want you to take the training because we want you to know what you're looking for and what to do if you see it. Mm-hmm. But I spent quite a lot of my 20s having the conversation with people of, well, I'm offended you would even ask me, do you think I would do that? No. And that's not the point.
Yeah. Well, I had to take it, but I was teaching, you know, helping with the confirmation kids, and I had to take it. I think it must have just got instituted in the Catholic Church maybe within the last,
2002, I think.
2002. Mm-hmm. But the way that I thought they taught it was to identify, but also mm-hmm. not to put yourself in situations where you
right.
could be accused.
That's
so
right. yeah.
if you had kids in your home, you
that's
make
right.
sure somebody else was there. You
right.
know, don't
right. You never do things,
that,
yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and don't have, you know, church programs where one adult is taking the kids
yeah.
somewhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. that should be raising a red flag, and you should say, it's not a really good idea for one adult to take a group of kids.
Well, the Safe Church training is you're not supposed to be alone with a kid.
That's right.
Ever. So does that apply to priests and confession?
It does. If I were hearing the confession of a child, I would do it somewhere where someone could see me, but not necessarily hear me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I might, I haven't had the circumstance in my ministry where a minor has wanted to come to confession. Uh-huh. But if that were to happen here, I might do it during a time that Liz is here, and we might sit here where she can see us, but not hear the content of the confession. But if you come to communion often enough here, you will hear... kids who don't receive communion, before I put my thumb on their forehead, I will say, is it all right if I put my thumb on your forehead to give you a blessing? Oh, uh-huh. Because what I want to model is, you as a, to the children is, you have the right to say who touches you, even, receiving a blessing at communion. And I have a couple of kids who have said, no, I would prefer you not put your thumb. And so I give them the blessing over their head. And I ask them every time. And I've had a couple of parents say, you don't have to ask them every time. I'm like, yes, I do. Because giving me permission to put my thumb on their forehead last week is not giving me permission to do it this week. That's my personal ethic.
Because I haven't been a Eucharistic minister now, but, I've never thought of that. I figure if they present themselves, the kids come up like this, that I'm okay to put my hand on their head. But
And parents have said that, too. And I'm like, I get that. But I really want to reinforce with, this is a place where you get to say, who. And every place should be a place that you get to say.
Right.
That should
be
something that...
It's a good example for the children.
Right. That you have the right to say who touches you, even to the extent of... No, Pastor Vicky, I don't want you to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just to even get them in the habit of saying it in the same place,
Right, and that it is not something that should offend people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Saying, I don't want to be touched should not get a reaction of, well, you've offended me,
Right.
Because it's really hard as a kid to tell somebody in authority what you don't want them to do. Mm-hmm. So... But that's, I have colleagues who think I'm nuts. That's ridiculous. You don't have to do that. Well, I don't have to, but that's, that's my ethic of how I practice my ministry. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be yours. But, but the institution hasn't. The institution has rules, and then you can go beyond the rules of the institution. But to talk about the Catholic Church just for a minute, before I came here, I was the title was Canon to the Ordinary in Southern Ohio, and that title is in the Catholic Church. It's Vicar General. It's kind of senior assistant to the bishop, the person who does all the stuff the bishop's office needs to have done that the bishop doesn't want to do. And one of the things that was in my portfolio was safe church training and making sure that congregations were compliant and that everyone, was compliant who was compliant. But while I was in that position, the Archdiocese of Cincinnati got struck with sexual misconduct complaints and were looking at instituting training and things. And my counterpart in the Archdiocese asked if I would come over and share with them our materials and our policies and all of those things. I said, sure, happy to. So I packed up all my traps and went over and showed him our training materials and our policies. And he says, okay, so who's required to take this training? And so we're, having this conversation. So I'm like, well, anybody who regularly works with youth groups, anybody who's a warden or a member of the vestry who's in a position to approve programs with children. We recommend it for Sunday school teachers. We didn't at that point require it for Sunday school teachers because where Sunday school teachers work with children, there's always other people around and in groups. It's not like they're going off site with the kids. Anybody who's an employee of the church, and then And I just kind of threw it away because I kind of thought it went without saying. Oh, and of course, anybody who's in the process of being ordained or who is a priest. And he stopped me and said, you require it of people in the ordination process? I said, yeah, that's, you know.
Those are the main offenders.
Yes, of course we do, that's, you know, as a priest, you are involved in every aspect of the church, of course. You know, if we're going to require the sexton to take it, we're certainly going to require the priest to take it. Don't people leave the ordination process? And I kind of looked at him and I said, over being required to take an 8-hour class on preventing child sexual abuse? No. And if somebody did, I would really feel like maybe that was a good thing. That, you know, if really seriously you're not willing to spend 8 hours on how to make your church a safe place for children, maybe we don't want you. And he said, and I'll remember this until I die, he looked at me and he said, we could never institute something that might lead to somebody leaving the ordination process.
Oh, my God. Really?
I went,
How old a man was this?
He was, well, let's see. I was in my late 30s. He was a little older than me.
Really?
But not a lot older than me. Uh-huh. But we could never, we have such a clergy shortage that we would never, we could never.
That's what I'm wondering.
And I was like,
to make women priests.
I was like, well,
another issue.
I can't tell you what you know. I'm not a Catholic priest. I can't tell you what you should do. But really, seriously, if somebody's willing to leave the ordination process over sexual misconduct prevention training,
wow, better they go.
I think you probably have a bigger problem than than getting them trained. But that's, you know.
Well, basically, they should allow priests to get married.
Well, that's a whole different question.
And female priests.
Yeah.
And female other things.
Sure.
Well, that, you know, those are all different.
But there's nothing in the Bible to justify that, to mandate that priests have to be celibate, right?
No, and for the first 500 or 600 years of the Christian church, ministers, priests did get married. Mm-hmm. Bishops got married. It was only as the church began to acquire property that it became complicated. Because if you're the priest at a church, do you own the church property and can you pass it down to your children? Or does the church own the church property?
Or if it's divorced.
Well, yeah, yes, but that was, you know, that was a whole different thing. But it really was about inheriting.
It wasn't clear that the church owns the property and not the individual?
Not in the Middle Ages.
Really?
Not in the Middle Ages. Not at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about bishops who effectively were princes, well, princes pass their property and their titles to their sons. Mm-hmm. Do princes of the church? So that's the real reason for celibacy. Mm-hmm. Was to make it clear that, and then there were, as in most things in the church, the church starts doing something and then develops the theology about why they do it. And that's true of everything. Why do we baptize infants? Because we started baptizing infants. And then we developed a theology around infant baptism, but the practice of baptizing infants came well before an established theology. And you can see it in trivial things, right? When I was trained to be an acolyte, I was taught there are two candles on the altar. One represents the Old Testament and one represents the Gospel. You always light the Old Testament candle first because the Gospel doesn't stand apart from the Old Testament. Okay? Which is the Gospel candle? Well, it's the one on the side of the church from which we read the Gospel. Except we read the Gospel from the middle of the aisle now, but we used to read the Gospel from one side. That's all crap. We, you know, we have We have two candles on the altar because at some point it looked balanced and it was enough light to read by. Why do we light them in the order we light them? Because that's the order we light them in. These are things about which God does not care, right? God did not say. And if you go to a different congregation, they may do it differently. And they will have very important reasons why they do it. But the reasons are not the reasons, right? We do what we do, and then we figure out why we do it. So, and I love this story. My seminary liturgics professor told me this story, and it really illustrates how the church does stuff. When he got to his first church as a young priest, all of the people sat on the left-hand side of the church until the peace, and then they moved to the right-hand side of the church. Everybody, to a person.
Really? Wow.
This was very strange. And he, but you know, he had been well taught as a young priest to not make waves early, and so he watched it for a couple of weeks, and then he started saying, "Why do you do this?" And somebody said, "Well, we start on the Old Testament side, and then we move to the Gospel side." He said, "Except you don't. You start on the Gospel side and move to." Oh, well. You know, and so he asked me, kept asking somebody else, and never got an answer. Finally, he was on a communion visit to one of the founding members of the parish, who was at that point in her 90s. He said, "I'm really confused about something. Do you know why they started this?" "Sure, Father, it's really simple. When the church was first built, we heated the church with a potbelly stove that was on the left-hand side of the church. And when you first got to church, it was too cold if you didn't sit near the stove. So we all sat on the left-hand side of the church near the stove. Well, by the peace, it was too warm near the stove, so we all moved over to the other side of the church for the rest of the service." But they still, I mean, they no longer used a potbelly stove. They hadn't for years.
Right.
But they still
did the practice,
right? And it's, of course, not just the church that does these things. You know, the story of, you know, the woman who is learning from her grandmother how to make pot roast. And her grandmother cuts the ends, both ends off the roast, and then puts it in the pot. And says, "Well, why do you do that?" "It's what you do, you know, this is how you make," and you know, came up with some reason. "That doesn't make any sense." So went back to her great-grandmother and said, "Why do you do this?" She said, "Well, because when I first started making pot roast, my pot was too small."
Oh.
"So I cut the ends off the roast so it would fit in the pot roast, you know, in the pot, and then use the but, you know,
yeah.
It's human nature. We do what we do. Mm-hmm. And then when someone asks, "Well, why are you doing that?" "Well, because it's what I was taught to do."
Yeah.
You know? Wow. So I'm not sure what got me off on that trajectory, but it's important as we talk about practices, and particularly as we talk about social justice, to think about why we do what we do. Because there are things we do that we assume are the way they've always been done. Excuse me. That aren't necessarily, and maybe the reasons we think we do them aren't really the reasons we do them. They're just, you know, the reasons that have come up. It's now 11 o'clock, so that's a good place to stop.
Okay.
We will come back and talk about trying to get back to individual versus group rights.
Maybe that's before you stop, though,
yeah.
Under migrants, you
yes.
had refugees, asylum seekers.
Yeah,
how many categories are there?
There's several.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Five or six.
Oh.
So.
Wow.